Okay, welcome to... Yeah, I'm getting old. Have to move this up. Session 22 on Proposition 22. Now, this is session... Yeah, session 22.
That's right. I think it was not a mistake.
You think that's... my name's Albert Peck, and I'm the editor of Sunstone Magazine, and I did not experience the dynamic here in California with Proposition 22 because I live in Utah. So I'm very interested in hearing the responses. I only heard anecdotes from friends who would tell me this is. This clearly is a topic that has wrenched the hearts and feelings of many California Mormons, and certainly those who attend Sunstone. They were the organizers of this conference were surprised at the number of people who made proposals to speak on this topic at this conference. So I hope that we can bring light and not heat to this issue. There's been enough heat given. And I suspect that this might be a tape that will be listened to and reproduced and shared widely in certain quarters of the church. So we'll begin with our four panelists. These four people were chosen because two of them voted for the proposition and two of them voted against the proposition. We've asked them to speak on two things. First, to describe why they voted for or against the proposition. And second, the experience as they had observed it in their ward and how the ward and the church community dealt with the issue of the church's strong support in organizing to support Proposition 22. Our four panelists are John Taylor, who voted for the proposition. He's an attorney in Los Angeles, a former counselor in a bishopric. John and I knew each other at BYU, where we were organizers of an anti-war conference at BYU. Alan Hansen, who voted for Proposition 22. Against it, excuse me. He's a product marketing manager with my eyes. I should have brought my reading glasses. At PO.com. And he's a parent and a foster parent. And he became famous because his name appeared in the newspaper and then there were news stories about you, which I'm sure you'll talk about. And then Derek Lines. He's attending dental school at USC, and he's an Elders Quorum president. Derek voted for the proposition. And then we'll conclude with Janet Brigham, who voted against Prop 22. She's a researcher in addiction and tobacco issues. She has a PhD in experimental psychology from BYU. And she's a resident of Menlo Park. So we'll turn the time over to them, and they're each going to speak about for 15 minutes, and then we'll see where we go after that in terms of comments and questions and their own responses to each other. So first to John.
Thanks, Albert. I had a job last night that I shut up for this discussion and nobody came, and they said, okay, you guys can all leave. So thank you for... I guess making this possible by showing up. I do want to thank Sunstone for inviting me to be on this panel to explain my reasons for supporting Proposition 22. My only prior Sunstone speaking experience was in rebuttal to a talk Eugene England once gave here entitled Why Orange County Mormons Should Be Democrats. And since Gene is a good friend of mine, he took my rebuttal in good humor, and I hope what I say today also will not offend. When Todd Compton invited me to be on this panel, he explained, we're having a hard time finding anyone willing to defend the church's position on Prop 22. And I actually laughed out loud when he said that, since his comment seemed to reinforce the stereotype most church members have about Sunstone readers. But nonetheless, I hope and believe that among the California Sunstone crowd, that there are many others besides myself who supported Prop 22, even if it meant setting aside some deeply held personal political views. By way of background, I've been a Sunstone and Dialogue subscriber for many years. I've served as a member of the Bishopric of the Los Angeles Singles Ward under Bishop Robert Reese, who many of you know, as Bishop of the Student Ward at USC, and as a member of the Los Angeles Stake Presidency. In each of those callings, I've had many experiences with members of the church who are dealing with same-sex attraction issues, and I have a great deal of sympathy for the challenges they face in attempting to keep the commandments as revealed through modern prophets. During my tenure as bishop of the USC ward, I formed a close friendship with a gay member of my ward that continues to this day, and in addition, two of my law firm partners, whom I consider to be friends, are also openly gay. I hope and believe that nobody who knows me, especially my gay friends, would consider me to be homophobic or bigoted against homosexuals. Specifically with regard to Prop 22, if I'd followed my self-interest with regard to the proposition, it probably would have led me to oppose the proposition. I work in a medium-sized law firm of predominantly Jewish liberal attorneys, in which it was politically incorrect to support Prop 22, and I think during the entire campaign, I never heard a single person in my office say anything in favor of the proposition. And so it was uncomfortable to be to not be in alignment with friends whose opinions I normally value. Also, at the time, our financial circumstances were kind of uncertain, and the request for a contribution, which was made at a general meeting without coercion, no one suggested a specific figure or gave us a quota or even followed up to confirm whether we had in fact contributed. But we did make a financial sacrifice to contribute, and it would have been easy to avoid doing so on the ground of an ideological disagreement with the church's position. For me, though, the biggest challenge was not a financial one, but when I was asked to serve as a local team leader to organize precinct walkers in my ward. Walking precincts in connection with Prop 22 and asked others in the ward to do so was, for me, the hardest assignment I've had in church since my mission, and I've had a lot of dispositions. So I would have eagerly refused to do that if my beliefs did not compel me to do so. So in explaining today why I voted in favor of Prop 22, I could get into the merits of the proposition. I think we've heard a lot about those in prior sessions that were part of the public debate surrounding its passage. But I think for those here like myself who are members of the church, those considerations were largely irrelevant. I think the real issue is this. Are we ever justified in refusing to follow the living prophet, including those we sustain as prophets, seers, and revelators, when they have spoken with clarity on an issue? These are the words of President Hinckley in his October 1999 General Conference Priesthood Session address. We regard it not only as our right, but our duty to oppose those forces which we feel undermine the moral fiber of society. There is no justification to redefine what marriage is. Such is not our right, and those who try will find themselves answerable to God. Some portray legalization of so-called same-sex marriage as a civil right. This is not a matter of civil rights, it is a matter of morality. Other than our constitutional right as a church to raise our voice on an issue that is of critical importance to the future of the family. We believe that defending the sacred institution by working to preserve traditional marriage lies clearly within our religious and constitutional prerogatives. Indeed, we are compelled by our doctrine to speak out. President Hinckley's clarion call was subsequently reinforced by video messages from three of the 12 apostles. In his message, Elder Ballard said that our Heavenly Father's plan is very plan is at risk, and that we must support this most important moral issue with our time, talents, and means. We are also told that the 12 were unanimous in support of all that President Hinckley and the other three have said on the issue. I believe that once such statements are made by the prophet, who is authorized to exercise all priesthood keys in leading the church, our duty is to be one with and support him, even if it is contrary to our own feelings. What else can be meant when we respond affirmatively to the question, do you sustain the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as prophet, seer, and revelator? I don't believe that anyone having heard or heard of the prophet's general conference address and the three video messages from the apostles who we also sustain as prophets, seers, and revelators could oppose Prop 22 and remain in harmony with the most basic of all gospel concepts, obedience to the living prophets. I'm aware that some church members and some even close friends believe that they have studied it out in their own mind and received revelation not to support Proposition 22. Without meaning to offend, I can't believe that the Holy Ghost is giving out contradictory messages to the Lord's prophet and to individual church members. It just doesn't compute to me. In fact, the Lord has told us that he will not lead his prophet, he will not allow his prophet to lead the people astray. If anything is certain about gospel doctrine, to me, it is that the Lord would not give us different instructions as individuals than he gave President Hinckley in his capacity as prophet, protestations to the contrary notwithstanding. In order to hold an opposite view, one would have to maintain that President Hinckley, who holds all the keys of exaltation and the priesthood and is the head of the Lord's church and his listmen, was not speaking for the Lord when he gave strong and clear direction in general conference, that he couldn't have been inspired to do so, that he was even doctrinally in error. To me, that is tantamount to denying revelation. If I understand the opposition of some church members of Prop 22, it is based on a misapplication of Jefferson's reference to a separation of church and state. Jefferson was referring to the government's obligation to stay out of religious affairs. Some would turn his statement on its head to argue that the Lord's church has no right to take a position on so-called political issues. Thus, some members apparently think that the Lord has drawn boundaries or put up stakes which set the bounds of what the church may do, and that nothing or nobody can change or go beyond those boundaries, even God. In effect, they would draw a line before the Almighty, saying, "Up to here you can come, but no further." Concerning this notion, Joseph Smith once said, "It is the constitutional disposition of mankind to set up stakes and set bounds to the works and ways of the Almighty. I say to those who are disposed to set up stakes for the Almighty, you will come short of the glory of God." The prophet Joseph also said, "Men may preach and practice everything except those things which God commands us to do, and will be damned at last. We may tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and not obey and teach others to obey God and just what he tells us to do. It mattereth not whether the principle is popular or unpopular. I always maintain a true principle, even if I stand alone in it." He whom we call our king, among other titles, certainly has to tell us anything he believes we should be doing, including what the world may call political activities, whether or not we as humans, with the limited knowledge, with limited vision, understand the full reasons. Rather than worshiping the golden calf of our own political views, I believe we should submit to the Lord's will as expressed by his ordained prophet. Nonetheless, some church members defended their opposition to Prop 22 on the ground that despite the counsel of the prophet, we were still entitled to exercise our free agency and vote against it. But the mere existence of a right to choose can never be the excuse for a disobedient choice. Some held hostage their obedience because they wanted their intellect satisfied first. But Adam did not know why he was sacrificing to the Lord, only that he was commanded to do so, which that he received a full explanation from an angel regarding what the sacrifice represented. Likewise, Abraham did not demand that his intellect be satisfied when he was tested with Isaac, nor did he refuse to obey until the seemingly illogical act was explained to him. As the scripture makes clear, although Abraham didn't know how things were going to turn out, he became the father of faith through obedience, and God provided a ram instead. In opposing Prop 22, some church members apparently felt that protecting the gay community from any discomfort caused by its passage was more important than sustaining the living prophet. If some were offended, left the church, or otherwise chose to react histrionically or even tragically in protest, that did not excuse us from the obligation to follow the call of the prophet. Nor does seeking to protect traditional marriage against erosion by voting to legalizing gay marriages make anyone a gay basher, any more than it would make God a gay basher. As the Savior commanded us, "My doctrine is not mine, but him who sent me." President Hinckley instructed us that the opposition of same-sex marriage should never be interpreted as justification for hatred, intolerance, or abuse of gays and lesbians. We love and honor them as sons and daughters of God. We were therefore required, as Elder Maxwell said so eloquently, to engage in advocacy without animosity. That, however, changed the Lord's doctrine, nor our duty to be advocates for Prop 22. To sum up, the prophet Joseph once said, "Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reasons thereof till long after the events transpire." Although the wisdom of supporting Prop 22 may not have been readily apparent to all church members, I believe our duty was to follow and support the prophet rather than becoming vocal critics of his call.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here. I haven't presented at a Sunstone conference before, but I'm pleased to be part of this panel. I've really enjoyed the conference, too. I think the different speakers have been great, and there have been some terrific questions and comments made in the hallways and in the different auditoriums. This panel is about Proposition 22, but the focus of my discussion is on children. How many people in this room know at least one child? I want you all to think about that child and your own childhood. Some of the vulnerabilities you experienced as a child were resolved, and perhaps you still carry some with you today. In June of 1994, I was married, and in October of 1995, I became a father. The following March, I found myself in the living room of my little two-bedroom duplex being asked a series of very personal questions by an interviewer who we had invited into our home to study it as a possible destination for children in the California foster care system. When I stepped out of the room, my wife told the interviewer that it may be best not to place gay children or children with gay parents in our home because she knew of my discomfort with homosexuality. When I came back in the room, the interviewer had moved on to the next subject about what gender child we wanted. She asked, "How do you feel about sex?" Not catching up, I responded, "We like it." Was I allowing my prejudice to prevent me from helping a child? At some point, my eyes were open to the prejudice I carried, and it took a long time and a lot of experiences and a lot of lessons to overcome it. I look back on an experience I had while living in San Francisco. I was attending the San Francisco Singles Ward, and one Sunday the bishop announced that a gay member of the ward had passed away the preceding week because of AIDS-related pneumonia. During the same Sunday service, a victim of a gay hate crime, his face badly battered, exercised his priesthood as he broke and blessed the bread during the sacrament service. I began to question myself about why this person rejected the violence, and I began to evaluate my own actions and feelings. Were my feelings towards homosexuals consistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ? I felt deeply conflicted. Later I came to ask, should I believe what Gordon B. Hinckley said? We are not anti-gay. Or should I believe what I see the church doing? For a church that claims gays are welcome in the church, there has certainly been a great effort to keep gay Boy Scouts. But vowing last week to revoke their support from scouting if the Supreme Court upholds New Jersey law. And then from the Salt Lake Tribune. If the Boy Scouts of America is forced to accept gays as scoutmasters, the LDS Church will withdraw from the organization and take more than 400,000 scouts with it. That's the contention of Salt Lake City Attorney Von G. Keech, who has filed a brief with the Supreme Court supporting the Boy Scouts' ban on homosexuals on behalf of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and four other religious organizations. The Church's message seems to be a source of conflict. Are homosexuals acceptable? Can they serve in the Church? Can they serve in the Church calling of Scoutmaster? It would seem that President Hinckley's statement, "We are not anti-gay," is not consistent with the Church's statement to the Supreme Court. This type of inconsistency is the source of conflict and misunderstanding for people in the Church and people who hear its message. I have observed that conflict often motivates the evolution or change of ideas. I have experienced such a change. As a teenager, I was the first to exclude anyone who I thought was gay. I didn't want to be considered as a friend of a gay person, and I didn't want anyone to think I might be gay. As an adult, I studied the issue on my own, and I have put away childish things, including childish attitudes, and have learned a measure of tolerance, compassion, and acceptance. I'll spend a few minutes sharing some thoughts and information about foster children and then contrast their situation with that of children in homosexual homes. The first foster child who lived in our home was brought to the county children's shelter at the tender age of 4 years old. He was captured at a police drug raid, not very different, I think, from the raid which captured little Elian Gonzalez last week in Miami. When he came to us, he was malnourished, dirty, and dazed from all that had transpired the previous 2 days. He had no clothes except what he was wearing, but he was the most pleasant, sweetest, beautiful child I had ever associated with. Our little boy was on the path to destruction in his life with his mother. His mother was addicted to heroin, and his father was not even aware that he had a son. Thousands of children all over the state and nation are placed in foster care if their parents do not act responsibly. Many children in foster care return to their biological parents, and still others are adopted from the state care system. A large number, however, grow up in foster care or state care, and theirs is a sad future. At age 18, children are thrown out of state institutions. And they have no claim on the state or on any person for their care. Imagine turning 18 and not being able to call home for advice, money, or for a kind word. It is no surprise that many of them follow the path their parents followed, substituting sex for love, bearing children irresponsibly, substituting drugs for friendship, and substituting crime for employment. Children who turn 18 while in foster care or state care have almost insurmountable challenges as they enter adulthood. 27% of males and 10% of females are incarcerated before their 19th birthday. 37% do not finish high school. 33% received public assistance, and 18% of females had given birth. Before leaving care, 47% were receiving some kind of counseling or medication for mental health problems. That number dropped to 21% after leaving care, and we can speculate that that's because they lost access to it with the loss of state benefits. That information is from a study by Courtney and Piliavin, 1998. Many of these children are institutionalized for drug addiction, and many have children who are born drug addicted and are placed in foster care in the foster care system as a result. It's a vicious cycle with costly consequences for our society. Some costs are monetary, but the biggest cost is borne by the individual who finds themselves without the ability to function normally in society. There is no happiness in poverty, in jail, in drugs, in the bearing of illegitimate children, or etc. Contrast the situation of these children in foster care with that of those who grow up in homosexual homes. I'm going to credit Michael Wald, Stanford University professor of family law, with much of the research that I'm going to use for the next section. Over the past 20 years, there have been a number of studies of children being raised by lesbian or gay male parents. These studies have looked at many aspects of the children's development. From a public policy perspective, the most important considerations are whether the children living with gay parents were more likely than children in heterosexual homes to have problems in school, to have serious emotional problems, to engage in harmful behaviors such as drug use, early pregnancy, delinquency, to run away from home, or to have problems finding employment or adjusting to adulthood. These are the aspects of child development that are a major concern to society, both for the children's sake and for the community's own sake. These studies also looked at a number of other aspects of children's development. Did they have adequate self-esteem? How were their peer relations? How did they get along with their parents? Were they happy? Upon reviewing these studies, the American Psychological Association in 1995 concluded that the research indicates that children raised by gay parents are not disadvantaged in any significant respect relative to the children of heterosexual parents. Most significantly, for purposes of family policy, none of the studies support the claims that children raised by male or lesbian parents will have serious emotional, intellectual, or social development problems because of their parents' sexual orientation. In the one study that followed children raised from birth into adulthood by gay parents, the young adults did not differ from the young adults raised in heterosexual families with respect to employment, ability to find and relate to partners, or in their general sense of well-being. The vast majority of children in all the studies functioned well intelligently, did not engage in self-destructive behaviors, or in behaviors harmful to the community. In these regards, as well as in general well-being, they did not look different from their counterparts with heterosexual parents. The studies also find that children raised by gay male and lesbian parents get along as well with their parents and peers as children raised in heterosexual families. The research finds no differences between these groups of children in self-esteem or in characteristics such as leadership ability, self-reliance, interpersonal flexibility, and self-confidence. In a few studies, the children in same-sex households even seem to have higher levels of well-being in some respects than the comparison group of children from heterosexual families. It is clear to me that children who grow up in state or foster care would be better off being adopted by people who will love and support them. The state recognizes this, and recently Governor Gray Davis signed legislation making it easier for homosexuals to adopt. During the church's campaign for Proposition 22, one member of a local bishopric posted the following on the internet: "If you are LDS, then you should consider whether or not, you believe and accept the concept of a family and that it can be eternal. If you do, then you will recognize that a same-sex union with children will never be an eternal unit and consequently does not qualify as a family by the Lord's definition. Contrary to this assertion, I think Heavenly Father is pleased whenever anyone takes care of a child. He loves the children. Telling a child that he is not part of a family because his parents are not heterosexual is profoundly hurtful to the child. It's a vicious attack and a lie. Those who make such statements are slaves to ideas that are ultimately steeped in hatred towards homosexuals. The statements are offensive and deserving of condemnation in the strongest possible language. The Bible teaches us, but whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believes in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and drowned in the depth of the sea. God would want any person who is willing to take care of a child to be successful in that endeavor. The responsibilities of parenthood apply to any parent, regardless of circumstance. The proclamation on the family says, parents have a sacred duty to rear their children in love and righteousness, to provide for their physical and spiritual needs, to teach them to love and to observe the commandments of God and to be law-abiding citizens wherever they live. It does not mean some parents have these responsibilities and others don't. The Church's campaign for Proposition 22 was part of a much larger campaign against homosexuals. The Church fought same-sex marriage in Alaska and Hawaii. They are currently embattled against homosexuals who involve themselves in Boy Scouts, and they fought same-sex marriage in Vermont, but also fought civil unions, demonstrating that it's not just about protecting marriage. There is tremendous need for good families in our society. Homosexuals can and do have good families. And as a society, we should be expending every effort to protect our society's children by helping any individual or couple who is willing to go the extra mile for a child. Would anyone here be harmed if the Church pushed for recognition of all families instead of hatred and bigotry against those who don't fit the Church's contemporary definition? The studies of children of homosexual parents did show that the stigma against their families was a source of stress for the children. Again, see Professor Wald's studies. Children have enough problems, enough insecurities, without having them compounded by a society that constantly promotes hatred against their families or family members. If we are willing to use the term family for members of society who commit to each other and to their children, then we can enthusiastically pursue a course which provides equal benefits to all families. Another course is too often followed in the Church's campaign against homosexuals. The Church, our homes, our hearts, will never be a haven for all of God's children unless we make them such. Perhaps we should follow the example of a wonderful gay couple I know who fought against a tremendous sociological stigma and went to the extraordinary effort to adopt a child. If we take a page from their book, we will make an extraordinary effort to make sure they are successful as parents. This means that we will work to extend them the same benefits I enjoy with my beautiful wife and my lovely children. In conclusion, I invite everyone here and everyone who hears this tape to conduct some introspection. Would you protect a child and earn the Lord's blessing? Or would you offend a child by refusing them the right to be part of a family and thereby request your very own millstone necklace? For me, I know which way I face. I face God, seeking His guidance, and I won't turn my back on Him. And I say these things in the name of Alan, Yvette, James, Jessica, and Nicholas, and in the name of foster children, children of homosexuals, and all of the outcasts everywhere. Amen.
Judging from the two previous sessions I attended, I am one of the most unpopular people here today. My guess is that anything I say here will not change anyone's mind and may likely make people upset with me, because this issue is very personally felt and is very personal to many people. Everything I say will not be as articulate or as well researched as other arguments I've heard advanced here today. I even imagine people could probably portray most things I say here in a very bad light. No matter what I say, some might even come away from what I say believing I'm a bigot. Nevertheless, I accept the purpose of Sunstone is to welcome honest ponderings of Latter-day Saints, and that such ponderings will be accepted no matter how difficult, with intelligence and goodwill. So I proceed. For Proposition 22, for me, is an issue that involves three very personal and complex issues: politics, religion, and same-sex relationships. My religious experience, political beliefs, and impressions about gays and lesbians began to form into ideas I could really call my own during high school. I attended a liberal private high school where diversity was encouraged and a free exchange of ideas was promulgated. There were students in a high school of only 500. There was a club that discussed gay and lesbian issues. In the two activities I participated in, drama and debate, I was friends with four people who made no secret about their sexual orientation. There were classmates who were uncomfortable with these homosexual students, but for most it was a non-issue. In fact, the most negative thing I heard about gays during high school were from church members. I remember when I was 17, a fellow priest and our priest quorum advisor exchanged comments about their dislike and disgust with homosexuals, adding clear implications of violence. I felt both angst and sadness that two Mormons I respected could be so crudely homophobic. However, my experience growing up in the church taught me that homosexuality as a practice is wrong. Along with other sexual sins, homosexuality was clearly defined as an abuse and misdirection of the sacred trust of sexual expression the Lord has given us. The testimony I gained of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ during these important high school years included a belief in the importance of the law of chastity. For me, homosexuality, along with premarital sex, pornography, profanity, drinking, and other word of wisdom prohibitions, became one of the many things that fellow classmates and even my own closest non-member friends engaged in, but which I did not. Due to my unique lifestyle, and despite my fairly liberal political beliefs, the label of conservative was quickly applied to me. I was therefore quite surprised when I began my freshman year at BYU that I was a minority once again, this time, however, firmly in the camp of what other students considered radical liberalism. A 1992 Clinton Gore campaign sign put up on my campus room door engendered not only repeated vandalism to the sign, but frequent political conversations. The one thing that surprised me about these conversations that I had not encountered before was how often church doctrine and general authority statements were misused by these other students to support their position or attack mine. This unfair and uninformed mix of religion and politics pushed me to seek out ways to express my minority views. Thus, my freshman year, I began engaging in such subversive activities as joining the college Democrats and writing for an alternative off-campus newspaper called the Student Review. A two-year mission to Germany following my freshman year increased my enthusiasm for the gospel and increased my desire to pursue open forums for discussion of religious and political ideas. Thus, when I returned, in addition to College Democrats and Student Review, I began reading back issues of Dialogue and Sunstone in the BYU library, attending Sunstone Symposia, and participated in a Marxist reading group, and to top it off, chose to major in the philosophy, that is, as a friend jokingly pointed out to me, the philosophies of men. I enjoyed this time of intellectual and spiritual exploration. The education I received and the experiences I had at BYU were almost universally positive. However, I was still sometimes surprised at the use of what I felt was unofficial church doctrine and statements by church leaders, by individuals as a single controlling factor in their political thinking. After writing an article for the Student Review on my opposition to capital punishment, I received a letter from a student demanding a retraction from the paper and that I repent of my apostate beliefs. More recently, my younger brother, currently studying at BYU, had a girlfriend who ended an otherwise pleasant relationship because of his generally private views against the death penalty. My dismay with the heavy influence of religion weighing on political issues all spilled over into the area of same-sex attraction. When I once expressed the view that I believe some gays and lesbians were either born with or developed same-sex attraction through no choice of their own, I was derided and ridiculed by a fellow student as relying too much on questionable scientific data and homosexual propaganda. I was also shocked when a student poll revealed that 42% of BYU students felt anyone with same-sex attraction should not be allowed at BYU, even if they were abiding by its honor code, which includes abstinence. Because of views such as these, my heart went out to a good friend of mine at BYU who bravely admitted that he was gay. So now this brings me to the issue at hand. Why did I support Proposition 22? In text for my discussion, I would like to use the first book of Nephi, chapter 4. In this chapter, Nephi and his two brothers are trying to get the place ruined. After two unsuccessful attempts, Nephi sneaks into Jerusalem under cover of darkness. And in verse 6, he says, "And I was led by the Spirit, not knowing beforehand the things that I should do." Nephi then discovers Laban drunk and sprawled on the ground. After Nephi examines Laban's sword, in verse 10, he says, "And it came to pass that I was constrained by the Spirit that I should kill Laban." But I said in my heart, many times have I shed the blood of man, and I shrunk, and would that I might not slay him. Nephi recoils from this most gruesome command, and I think one of the reasons Nephi is especially horrified is that he knows he is going to do it. He will go and do the things which the Lord commands of him, as he so boldly professed before setting out on this task. In verse 11, the Spirit reminds Nephi simply, "Behold, the Lord has delivered him into thy hands." At this point, Nephi does an interesting thing. He could have simply continued his record by saying, as he does in verse 18, "Therefore I did obey the voice of the Lord." Instead of simply continuing his narrative in this way, however, Nephi spends 7 verses giving, as I number them, 5 reasons to support his actions. Now, it is purely supposition on my part, but I believe Nephi provides these reasonable explanations partly for the benefit of the reader and partially for himself, to provide some logical structure to this command he has been given. He could have simply said, "The Lord told me to do it, so I did it." There would ultimately be no more important reason than that. Often one must obey with incomplete understanding, hence the need for faith. Nevertheless, when I am faced with a difficult command, one that makes me shrink from obeying, through my faith I seek to understand. Nephi also sought for such understanding. In verses 11 through 17, he gives reasons for his obedience. I will not go into everything he says, but it is fascinating to read. Now, I won't delay any longer. I would like to use this text to explain my feelings about Proposition 22. I first heard the initial rumblings about this issue in May last year. I seem to have missed the letter from the Area Presidency concerning Prop 22 when it was read in church in late May, but I was aware of a ballot initiative and the stand the church would be taking. I was also vaguely aware the church was connected with other issues involving same-sex relationships, especially in Hawaii. It really caught my attention, however, when I read a short snippet in Newsweek. It said it was the Mormon Church was asking members to donate money to the California proposition that would define marriage as being only between a man and woman. My first reaction to this news was, why? Why was the church getting so heavily involved in this political issue that it would request money be given in support? Would they go as far as to tell members how to vote on this issue? As the rumblings about Prop 22 became louder, so did my discomfort, not because I'd made up my mind against it necessarily, but because I was uncomfortable with the church authority or perceived church authority being used on this issue. I fear the experience in the past that perhaps members were misunderstanding, overemphasizing, or taking as official pronouncements the opinions of those in authority. It was in October General Conference, however, that a defining moment occurred to me. In the priesthood session, President Hinckley directly addressed the issue of Prop 22 in California. He said, "We regard it not only as our right, but our duty to oppose those forces which we feel undermine the moral fiber of society. Such is currently the case in California, where Latter-day Saints are working as part of a coalition to safeguard traditional marriage from forces in our society which are attempting to redefine the sacred institution. God-sanctioned marriage between a man and a woman has been the basis of civilization for thousands of years. There is no justification to redefine what marriage is." This was a singular event in my life. I can't personally remember a prophet ever addressing a political issue so specifically and unequivocally. I must admit I had an initial feeling of recoil, of shrinking from the notion that the church was taking such a clear and public position on such a controversial political issue. However, at the same time, I knew I would support it. Why? I know President Hinckley is a prophet of God. In addition to the belief that every successor to Joseph Smith who has led this church has been a prophet, I have often felt the unmistakable witness of the Spirit as I have listened to the straightforward teachings of President Hinckley. I have faith in his calling as president of the church and as a chosen representative of the Lord. An important part of faith for me is trust. I trust President Hinckley, that he will make inspired decisions and that he will lead as the Lord desires. This faith and trust have been confirmed in the past by the careful yet bold way President Hinckley has handled media scrutiny of the church. After the prophet spoke, I knew I would support Prop 22. I confess I'm a New Mexico resident, and thus, being on this panel, I couldn't actually cast a ballot for Prop 22, but in the USC student ward, which my family and I attend, I was asked on a number of occasions to meet at the apartments of ward members where efforts were coordinated to walk voter precincts or make phone calls. I gave my time and support to all these efforts. I felt no pressure on a local level to support these efforts. I knew several ward members who vehemently disagreed with this issue and were not asked to participate in these efforts, and their opinions were widely known in the ward. Like Nephi in his decision, I also sought a reasonable framework with which to support my decision. These supporting contentions would not make or break my decision, but rather provide some helpful insight. As in most political issues, I believe both sides can make persuasive arguments for their views. Indeed, today I have heard some very forceful and persuasive arguments against Prop 22. There are three main explanations for the passage of Prop 22 I have found plausible in my understanding of this issue. They include arguments both for Prop 22 and in opposition to same-sex marriage in general. First, the passage of Prop 22 does not take away any rights homosexuals currently have. Despite the disingenuous claims of opponents, hospital visitation privileges would not be changed. In fact, in my limited understanding, California has one of the most expansive domestic partnership laws in the country, none of which was changed by Prop 22. Now, this is little consolation to those who want to see marriage rights expanded to seek same-sex marriage, and I understand that. Second, if Prop 22 was not passed and same-sex marriage from other states were recognized and allowed, then what is to stop others from redefining marriage even further? If marriage between two men and two women is allowed, what argument could one use to oppose a marriage between two men and a woman, a brother and a sister, or other unappealing possibilities? Although perhaps many would not clamor for such changes, the possibility exists and the precedent would already be set. My last reason for Prop 22 comes from a question similar to Nephi's when he wondered what would be the outcome of not obtaining the brass plates from Nephi, from Laban. My question is, what would be the outcome if marriage were redefined, allowing marriages of two men, two women, or other combinations society might eventually allow? In such a situation, I believe we may further lose the fundamental understanding of and respect for what the traditional family means to society. The family and marriage are already under attack by the forces of abuse, neglect, divorce, sexual infidelity, and the questioning even of marriage necessity, and I believe these forces are also paramount and should be counteracted to the best of our abilities. I find it ironic that while gays and lesbians are demanding the right to marry, many heterosexuals see marriage as increasingly irrelevant. Today, the empirical evidence is undeniable that the family breakdown feeds a host of social pathologies. A law allowing same-sex marriages would have a built-in message that marriage is nothing more than a human invention. This view of marriage as an arbitrary social construct would, in my opinion, only serve to further the demise of the family as a protection of stable societal stability and values. I also think the spread of the gospel and its saving ordinances could be frustrated as the rejection of the central role the traditional families play in God's plan would spread. Now, certainly all these contentions and prognostications can and have been disputed, and I've heard some very powerful cases against them today. So is the nature of this issue. My support on this issue, however, does not rise or fall with these arguments. It comes from a faith and trust in the prophet, a faith which for me transforms the saying, when the prophet has spoken, the thinking has been done, to when the prophet has spoken, the thinking has begun. Thank you.
In the mid-1970s, I lived for a brief time in the Washington, D.C. area, and one of the unofficial assignments I had in the ward, I had five callings in the ward, and one of the callings I was unofficially given was to accompany a stake missionary who had no companion. And so I accompanied her to some of the discussions that she was having with potential members of the church. On one of these occasions, we went to visit a woman that had had several of the discussions. We showed her a little film strip. This was before videos were invented. And as we were leaving, she walked us to the door, and she said, and I won't quote exactly what she said because it's language I don't use. She said, "You know what I like about you Mormons?" And we kind of innocently said, "No, what is it you like about us Mormons?" And she told us that what she liked about Mormons was that we hated blacks as much as she did. She didn't call them blacks. And we didn't go back to teach her. It seemed rather pointless. That was one of the more stunning experiences of my life and one of the few things I remember about that brief time that I lived in Washington. About 5 years later, I was working for the church in the capacity of a spokesperson in the public communications department in Salt Lake City. And one of the things I did in my work with press relations, this was back when I was in journalism. I don't do that anymore that much, but anyway, this was a different life I used to lead. And I was ushering around people from the press as they would come to Salt Lake to do stories about the church. This was one of the things in my job. And there was a woman from the Philadelphia Inquirer who was a well-known, decorated reporter. And she had come to Salt Lake City because of the church's opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. The reason she came to Salt Lake, specifically at that time, was because there were several wealthy matrons from Philadelphia who had come to picket on Temple Square. And she thought it was quite amazing that these women who had certainly many resources and many advantages in life would give a week or two of their time to come and picket for this cause. And so she wanted to come and find out what the story really was all about that would draw them to do this. And so she came. I set up several interviews for her. And anyway, I tried to help her write a fair story. She didn't want to write a biased story. She wanted to be fair. And she did write a fair story, but part of what she reported were some ugly things that occurred, such as these women being spat upon as they were picketing and being harshly treated by people who disagreed with them. And so in her story, she reported not only the good things, but also the unpleasant things. And a couple of weeks after her, it was a series of three articles that she wrote, and as each one came out and she would send them to us, I would barely be able to breathe until I could read them, hoping that some of the worst of what she could say, she wouldn't say, and indeed she didn't. She exercised what I thought was amazing restraint, considering the things that she could have written. We got a letter several weeks after these articles were published, and it was from a man who had read these articles and had decided to investigate and join the church based on what he'd read about the church in these articles. And what had drawn him to the church were the very kinds of things that I was hoping she wouldn't have to print. The negative attitudes toward women and the negative attitudes toward the women who were picketing in particular. And this is what had attracted him to the church. And he was happy to find people that were like-minded. Well, this rang a familiar bell with me. Skipping ahead to 1999, there was an occasion. This is a very difficult story to tell. There was an occasion last spring when my husband, Richard, and I went to Georgia for a music convention. And why is it the only woman on the panel is the only one who chokes up? Alan, couldn't you have choked up a little? A little, okay. Okay, that helps. Thank you so much. That helps, that helps. Okay, anyway, Richard and I went to this musical gathering, which was something we'd looked forward to for a long time. And also on this trip, although he traveled, you know, different groups of people had traveled separately, but also on this trip was a friend of ours who participates in some of the same kind of musical activities we do. And he's a man that I had known for several years before I knew he was gay. And it wasn't a big issue whether he was gay or not. It's just it came out because I'd asked him. He was talking about his spouse, and it turns out his spouse happens to be an Episcopal minister, who's a man, and they were adopting a young boy who would be orphaned. And so anyway, his sexual orientation came out, and I didn't really think much of it. At the time, it was just that's a fact of his life. And as we were sitting there in one of the singing sessions, I also happened to look. I was looking straight across at him. He was sitting in another section. And there was off to my left another fellow that I had found out during this musical thing happened to be gay. And I hadn't known he was gay either. I hadn't thought about it. And it only came up because I was asking, like, was he married and did he have children? Because there were pictures of children at his home. It turns out they were his students. He's a teacher. And I found out that he was gay. And like I said, these things didn't, you know, these are people's lives, and I don't tell them how to live their lives and hope they don't tell me how to live mine. But I was sitting there, and I realized as I was watching them that there were, you know, I was thinking about them, and I was thinking about this. I had just learned about the church's opposition to this pending proposition, and I was contemplating in my mind what exactly would constitute a sin, and who was a sinner, and were they sinful if they'd never had a covenant to not engage in certain kinds of activities. And, you know, kind of, I was just sitting there sort of weighing these things in my mind. And I probably shouldn't confess exactly how much I do weigh these kinds of things in my mind. I imagine I have some company in that. And as I was doing so, I was struck, probably as hard as I've ever been struck by something in my life. And I tell you this as a confessional, because I was chewed out, and I was chewed out royally, and it's no fun being chewed out by God. There are many people on earth I'd rather be chewed out by than deity. And what I was chewed out for was the judgment was mine. Judgment was God's, and judgment it was not mine to judge who was a sinner and who was not a sinner, or at what point in the person's life they were a sinner, and under what conditions they were a sinner. Even thinking that question was being judgmental and was outside the bounds of what was righteous to do, and that by even asking that question, I was committing the greater sin. That's a very sobering thing to realize when all you've done is have a thought. And then another realization came to me. And the other realization was that how we treat people who are different from us is the test of us, not the test of them. And the sense I had was that God will judge people, whatever their sexual orientation, as God judges them. And it will be a kind judgment. And it will be a judgment based on an understanding of every facet of the person's life. Facets I have no access to knowledge about, even about myself, most likely. And that this judgment would only be as kind toward me if I quit judging. And within that exchange probably took 10 to the 42nd seconds, for those of you who are in the science section. It took about as long as it took for the determination of the universe to occur after the Big Bang. But it was a Big Bang. And it changed my thinking. Now, I can't say that God said, and don't vote for Prop 22. How a person votes is really a very personal thing. And as an indication of how seriously I take voting, in 1980, I was living in the West, and Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter, who at that point was an incumbent with many problems. And Carter had conceded the election before I even got home from work. Reagan had announced victory. I then changed my clothes, went to the polls, and voted for Carter. That's how seriously I take a vote. And the issue for me was not how I voted on Prop 22, because Prop 22 will come and go. Voting for Prop 22 may end up being a vote against Prop 22 if it gets forced to the courts and the courts decide one way or another. Prop 22 was not the issue. How we treat people and how we consider people is the issue. And I believe very strongly that how we treat people who we consider to be the lepers of our day, whatever that condition, whether it's 30 years ago, 35 years ago, and we're considering the Civil Rights Act, or whether it's now and we're considering this act, or whether it's 10 years from now and it's another act, how we treat people and how they're affected and the choices we make regarding that are the judgment of us. Sometimes in my life I would face a decision between what's right and what's good. And sometimes when I was younger, I used to try to choose what was right, you know, do what is right, let the consequence follow, and so forth. And 20 years after having done that a few times, I've learned that what I should have chosen was what was good, because that was the better right. And I believe that was the choice I made in this case. At least it was a choice I tried to make. Let me address something that was also asked by Albert that really hasn't been addressed too much here, by either Alan or myself so far, and that is how our church situations related to how we voted. I was approached by a woman who was representing her husband, who had been called to be the Yes on Night director for our ward, and she called and asked if we would like to come to Fireside, and I said no, we wouldn't. And told her, I said, we have our own position on this, and she thanked me. And we never heard another word about it. And in the interim, they called me to be ward activities chairman. And I was sort of hoping, I think, in the back of my mind that maybe they wouldn't call me to be ward activities chairman if they thought I was just sufficiently reprobate I could get out of that. And I watched with considerable discomfort as all of the activities unfolded, as we had people trotting signs around, as it was announced in Relief Society, as we were instructed in Relief Society how to write letters and how to call talk shows, and as it was announced from the pulpit in a special priesthood's Relief Society meeting how we were to vote, and that donations were welcome and how they could be sent, and here are packets and we need 25 people to take these packets, And so we'll pass them out, and some hands went up eagerly, and some hands went up very reluctantly, and my hand didn't go up. And as I sat there thinking, it's not that long ago that blacks weren't allowed to marry, and it's not that long ago that, you know, other situations had occurred, and I am a scientist by training now, no longer being a journalist as I was, and I know from my own reading that we don't have conclusive answers as to the cause of sexual orientation. We think we understand some of the mechanisms, but we don't really understand what makes one thing happen or another thing happen in a conclusive way yet. And so I can't say why people are the way they are, and all I can do is try to change those things I can change within myself to try to accommodate a more Christ-like attitude within myself. And that's the only thing I can change. As to what occurred in the ward, nothing occurred in the ward that affected either my husband or myself. They tolerate us. they call on us. We don't, you know, we're not quiet people. But we also try not to be offensive people. And when people have a position, I try to respect their position, even if it's not my position, because I don't want them telling me how to vote either. And I don't want them telling me the things that I may feel really inclined to tell them. And I realize that there's a major split in the world between what's authoritarian and those people who are more authoritarian and those who aren't, and that this is just the way that the pie divides. And this is the way people look at the world, how they interact, the way they try to make decisions in their lives, and that the church needs to make and has made some effort to accommodate both sides. So I suppose that would be how I would sum up. I feel unaccountable for the decisions I make and the votes I cast. As Albert briefly said, I do tobacco research, and I'm a lot more concerned about the fact that over the next century, 900 million people are going to die from tobacco-related causes. And that I'd like to see the church do things about that. I'd like to see activities that reflected the realities of the world that we live in, and that reflected some of the very real threats to people being in the church and even being on the earth. And these are things I do have serious concerns about and where a great deal more of my time is spent. But I do hope that those who have had to deal with my intolerance, my judgmentalism, and my bad decisions over the course of my lifetime have the same kind of charity that I would try to afford to them.
Thank you. Great. Before we open up to questions, I have two questions or two parts of one question I'd like the panelists to consider and respond to. First is your observations on the internal, the results and the dynamics, the consequences on the internal dynamics of the ward because of how we engaged in Proposition 22. I remember at BYU, professors would comment on how the church was very wise in basically sitting out the civil rights movement because it kept the turmoil and contest that was going on in the culture from happening within our own wards and our own relief societies. And when that was finally resolved, the church was able to embrace the consensus without having split our wards while we were trying to build better Zion. And that seemed to me to be some prudence in that. This is a case where we engaged in a major hot social controversy of the day, and how did that influence how we live our lives as Christians trying to be one in our community? Second, this is the dynamic between Mormons and the larger world. Seems to me that when we've engaged in an issue that we have strong feelings about as Mormons, say the Equal Rights Amendment or abortion issues, there's a great temptation to label the opponents as evil. You know, we've all talked to people who were say, pro-ERA or pro-choice, who Mormons are just saying that they're tools of the devil and they're Satans and they're anti-family, when, you know, these people aren't. At least they don't perceive themselves as being that. And that hardening and polarization is lamentable. And I guess the fundamental question for both of these two questions, the dynamics, the consequences within the ward and the consequences between the Mormon community and the larger community, is trying to gain lessons from this experience on how we as Mormons can constructively engage the world and ourselves in questions that we have deep feelings about, to produce consequences that we're interested in. And this is important, I think, because we need to learn how to wisely do this, because we're growing in numbers. You know, right now we're 1.8% of the population. Suppose 30, 50 years the church is 5% of the U.S. population. With our mobilizing skills that were evident here in Proposition 22, we can effectively swing many votes. We can, as we have in the past, say in the Nauvoo times, alienate and scare the hell out of our non-Mormon friends, you know. We need to be careful so that we move to act as we see the good and try to infect that good in society so that we don't have unintended consequences. This is even more true in other countries. In Chile, the church has 3% of the population. And that has basically gone from 0 to 3% since World War II. It's a huge rise in a short period of time. It scares people, you know. So knowing how to act wisely on issues that we believe deeply in is hard to know how to do. We can be right and still act foolishly and bring about terrible consequences. So any thoughts on the internal dynamics and those external dynamics? You want to go first?
The last shall be first. I'm not sure that Mormons wielded a lot of political power when it came to Proposition 22. As I recall, now Dave would probably know more than I do about the statistics of the levels of support, but as I recall, the initial statistics on polling statistics from the state of California were fairly similar to what the actual vote ended up being. And this is after we spent, you know, all the money was spent on one side or another. It ended up being approximately the same as it was in the first place. And also the split was roughly, and it was an age divide that, as I recall hearing about the voting results from polling, what do you call exit polls, that younger people voted against Proposition 22 in the same proportion that older people voted for Proposition 22. And so it was really a generational issue more than a religious issue or a moral issue. And so I'm not sure that we have all this political power that we want to think we have. Yeah, the members did vote in a certain way, but I think they probably would have voted in a certain way anyway. Probably the only thing that happened was that a few people were persuaded to vote that might not have bothered to vote otherwise.
There's also an ethnic component of that, too. I think the Hispanic community came out in a larger percentage mm-hmm. in favor of Prop 22. And again, it may prove your point, which is things didn't really change from November to
yeah.
the rest of March.
Now here, why didn't you say that?
Well, I was just commenting that another demographic that showed where the support was in the Hispanic community. There was actually much wider support, I think, than in the rest of the Caucasian community in the state. And also confirming also that the numbers did not much between November and March. I think the church's effort, or fear at least, was that a lot of money would be poured in at the last minute by the No on 22 campaign, and that the church's efforts were aimed towards heading off a sudden loss in the polls on that issue at the last minute. And anyone can speculate about whether it would have changed or not if the church hadn't done anything. And I guess we may never know that.
But. I have a quick word on that same subject. We're talking about demographics. One of the things that was pointed out was that the Bay Area was the one area of the state that passed the proposition. Turns out that... that's what I meant. See, he got me confused at the very beginning. It was the one area of the state that defeated the proposition, And it's also interesting to note that demographically, that's the that those counties are some of the wealthiest counties and best educated counties in the state. And my county was one of the counties that was most dramatically passed by the widest margin passed the initiative, you know. And we have one of the poorest counties. San Joaquin County is one of the poorest and least educated in the state.
Before I give this up, I just wanted to comment. On my ward, in answer to question number one, it's hard to say as a member of the majority how the people who didn't favor Prop 22 felt about the dynamics in the ward. I was not aware of anyone who didn't support it, much less any persecution of anyone who didn't support it. So I think our bishop, who's a pretty understanding and sensitive man, did not try to make anyone feel uncomfortable if they were not supporting the proposition. As between, you know, our view of the larger world, did we in our ward sort of demonize those who didn't support Prop 22? I did not feel that. In fact, the one example I thought was kind of striking was a morning talk show I heard driving into work one day with a pro-Prop 22 and an anti-Prop 22, and the accusations of bigotry and racism and demonizing the other side all came from the no on 22 side. The person supporting the proposition tried to explain rationally why this was not a referendum on the gay lifestyle or wasn't changing the law. It was merely to protect the law that's already in place. And the rhetoric on the other side was all, this is a hate law. It's meant to divide. It's meant to persecute. And I frankly did not see that as the name of the proposition, but that's what the other side, I felt like, tried to paint the proponents of Prop 22 as having this ulterior, hateful motive in putting the proposition forward, which I thought was kind of an unfair tactic.
Just to respond briefly to both of Albert's questions, I think the internal dynamic in our student ward, it's a small, very close-knit ward, and so I think all of us are pretty much aware of where people are coming from, of people's political beliefs, of where they stand on various issues, and I can think of two people in particular who I knew were against the issue, and I didn't feel that anybody looked down on their views. There was nothing said in church across the pulpit that I felt was directly attacking them or their beliefs. And in fact, one time we were having a discussion, and I thought it was kind of getting a little heated, and I didn't want to damage a friendship over an issue like this. I didn't want it to come to something that where we might, I might regret something or she might regret something that would be said. So I also, as far as the external dynamic between Mormonism and the larger world and maybe their involvement in politics, I am still uncomfortable with the church being involved in politics. My personal opinion is that we should preach the gospel, we should send our missionaries out and try to change people's minds, and that risks try to get them to gain a testimony of what we're teaching, and thereby change whatever things that that we might think is needs to be changed in their life. So unless I feel that the prophet is saying we need to support something, I am uncomfortable with the church telling people how to vote. And I think that there can be some negative repercussions, but through my faith in what the prophet has said and trying to find intelligent and defensible reasons to support that, I will continue to do that. But I think in general, I am uncomfortable when the church gets involved in issues like this.
I just wanted to add on before we pass the topic of whether people were demonized because of their positions. There was certainly nothing coming over the pulpit that was to that effect. However, it was interpreted that way in Peace Minds. A woman in our ward who was very instrumental in orchestrating the letter writing campaigns and so forth referred to them in Relief Society as the enemy. And saying these people are trying to destroy our families, and you know we've got to fight against people who are trying to destroy our families, and that was her rhetoric. So I think it kind of depended on where you were and who you were talking to in terms of who was using the rhetoric. It was divisive, but oddly enough, the week after the election, I fully expected to go to church and hear a lot of gloating, and it wasn't mentioned. And, you know, it's like, that's over. You know, nobody cared about it, and they were on to the next thing they were doing in their lives. So I don't think it was an issue that had struck them deeply as a great moral cause that they were personally invested in. They were doing it because they were wanting to be good followers and to do the right thing in that sense. So if it tapped into fear and hatred that they had and a willingness to label people as the enemy, then that passed.
I had another paper I was going to present at this Sunstone Symposium, and I didn't do it because there were so many papers on Proposition 22. But my particular situation was different than anything that's been described here. I wrote a letter to the editor, and when that came out, I was called in the same day to the bishop's office. I was summarily released from my call as elders quorum instructor. I was told of the restrictions that had been placed on me, and then a week later I was placed on informal probation, and that's still going on today. It relates to the letter to the editor I wrote, which criticized Proposition 22 and criticized the idea of supporting it as a matter of religious conscience. One of the big problems with supporting something like this as a matter of religious conscience is it allows us, if we do that, if we say, I'm going to do this to follow the prophet, there's a couple of things. One, it says, the prophet knows better than I do about how I should conduct my life and how I should vote. And number two, it takes away all our responsibility. It's a free pass. It's a righteous thing, and that's a free pass. Well, a righteous thing and a free pass is not the Lord's plan. The Lord wants us to make our own decisions and to be responsible for our decisions. So the dynamic of the ward went downhill very quickly from January until the present time. We were told by a number of people we were right, a number of people who were too shy to express their feelings on the matter. But the people who said we were wrong said terrible things about us. We're trying to adopt one of our foster children. And one of the comments that was made was so visceral as to say that, well, they asked if we were adopting through church social services, and we weren't. But, when we said that's none of your business, they say, well, maybe it's the state president's business. As if to say that our opposition to Proposition 22 disqualified us from being able to adopt a child. I mean, what a rude thing to say. What an unchristian thing to say. And how it affected the world. I think that, clearly there was a lot of press about this, and certainly the homosexual community was alienated from the church. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think even my own bishop recognized it. When Stuart Mattis passed away, or took his own life, and before he had done that, he and I had been in communication, and he told me how deeply hurtful this was to him and to his friends, some of his gay friends. And so it is deeply hurtful, and because, maybe some of those people aren't here to represent themselves, but I can tell you, the ones I've talked to said that the church's campaign was very damaging to them, and it didn't make them feel like they wanted to be associated with the church. So it was damaging to the church in that way too, where we could have reached out. Instead, we pushed away. We drove a wedge. The other point that I want to make about that is that there were some small victories that we got along the way. And the night of Stuart Mattis's memorial service, which I attended, Robert Reese spoke. I was so touched by his words, I went back to my office at 10 o'clock at night, because it's an hour drive from my office to my home, and I called the bishop at his home, and I explained to him what had transpired, and that about the suicide and the memorial service, and I expressed to him some important views. One of them came from Section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants, where it talks about that reproving betimes, what does it say? With sharpness. When moved upon by the Holy Ghost. I'm in front of a lot of eyes here. But then showing an increase of love so that the person doesn't esteem you to be his enemy. And that means we reprove rarely. And to Janet's point, we don't really need to reprove that much, because it's not our sin. It's not our place to judge. And even if we have reproved, what have we done? What did they do over the course of May to right now to reach out to the homosexual community to invite them to come to Christ? And I say that there's very little, if anything. But I was impressed with my bishop's speech that he gave, and he gave it in priesthood meeting, and it moved him to tears to think that we have alienated some of the people that lived with his ward boundaries. And he used the words, We need the ward to be a haven for everyone, regardless of their sexual orientation, regardless of any sin, regardless of whether they smoke, drink, chew, or are immoral. And there are some broader issues there, but I think that that was one of the victories.
You put you on probation anyway, that same guy?
Yeah, he left me on probation, even though I was the one. He almost used verbatim the words that I gave him. And there's an account of that. Maybe if I'm lucky, I'll be able to talk about that at Sunstone in August.
Okay, hey.
I'm going to require you to come up here and hold a microphone so it gets recorded. So those too timid to come up. Come on up, Richard. Won't get to ask your question.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the dynamics in our ward. The ex-stake president, who was in charge of the fundraising and the whole campaign in our stake, gave a description every Sunday on the progress of their campaign, and he would talk about his individual efforts to go out and canvass people. And on two occasions, he actually made the comment that these people who were turning him down were the kind of people who would be willing to assist in marriage between an animal. It was so degrading in that kind of a situation. So there were very negative things said by people in our state. And I have one other comment. One of the early things that the No on Night campaign, one of their early campaign statements was that this program was divisive. And I was not quite tuned to that. I didn't understand how it would be divisive. And I had a very... difficult situation. I run a family email list. My parents have lots and lots of grandchildren, and there's 40 or 50 of us on this list. And one of my nephews, who lives in the East right now, had a very severe situation where a premature child was born about a year and a half ago. And the whole family rallied together, and because of this email list, we were able to pray together and fast, and it was a unifying thing. But then once I posted an editorial from the San Jose Mercury News that was sort of talking about both sides of the issue, it was very, very, very even-sided, and immediately this young man, who the whole family had rallied to, posted a message saying that he was going to shut himself off from the family, he was not going to talk to anybody else, and even if we sent an email message to him, he would refuse to listen to it. And I learned firsthand how divisive this issue could be.
Thank you.
Come on. Why don't you kind of form a little line on these front row chairs so you can distribute?
Yeah. Okay. Quickly, I think that one argument is unfair comparing drug abusing, abusive heterosexuals to loving homosexuals. As far as your statistics, it almost sounded like heterosexual marriage should be outlawed since the statistics are so bad. But let's compare loving heterosexuals and loving homosexuals. I mean, if we're going to use those kind of statistics. But I found little things in each argument, but I won't go into those. Let me ask a question. Emotionally, I was with you two. And intellectually, I was with you two. So here's the problem that I couldn't get beyond. And I'll just throw out three quotes, and you can respond to them. These are fictional quotes. I don't want anybody to call my bishop. I love my alcohol. I love my beer. How dare the church campaign for liquor by the drink or some other anti-drinking on Sunday laws? It's unfair that the church would do that to my personal preferences. Number two. My wife is not very affectionate. I love my mistress. It's a pure love. Why can't I marry her? Why can't the state recognize that? How dare you say that a certain kind of love is legitimate and my love with my three mistresses is not legitimate? And I guess the question I'm therefore saying is, how do you draw the line once you put down, 5,000 years of tradition? Where do you draw the line, and how can you legitimately draw the line anywhere? And that's the one problem I could never get beyond in my favoring Prop 22.
Anyone want to make any comments on this? Yes? No?
Either for Alan or...
in my original letter to the editor, I addressed this this very issue. The church certainly has the right to enforce whatever doctrines it wants. I mean, not just this church, but any church. If the Jehovah's Witnesses want to say you can't go to the hospital, you can't get a blood transfusion or whatever, they have a religious argument for being able to do that. Maybe there's some places where it crosses the bounds in some cases, and certainly cult religions and things have this problem. But when we're talking about religion in the church and the Doctrine and Covenants states this clearly, that the church's only recourse against anyone is to excommunicate them. And that's how the church resolves its differences. It doesn't have any power over anybody else. So whether it's alcohol, adultery, or some other thing that's forbidden by the church, if the church doesn't want to tolerate that kind of behavior, it can excommunicate people, and it can do it without venturing outside the grounds of, outside the walls of religious conduct.
So in Utah, they shouldn't enforce any drinking or tobacco laws. They shouldn't have any influence.
Well, it's not the church who's enforcing them; it's the state.
No, but they shouldn't try to influence that. Is what you're saying?
Well, I think
what about polygamy laws? They shouldn't try to influence that.
Well, I think the principle here is the church can teach a doctrine. Okay, and once the church has taught the doctrine, that's the end of it. The church can teach a doctrine that you don't drink, you don't smoke, you don't be in polygamous relationship. But when you're talking about somebody who's doing those things and is a member of the church can either excommunicate those people or not. And that's the church's choice. But as far as following the law and enforcing the law, that's for the police to do, and that's for the courts. That's why we have a judiciary system, and that's why we live in America and not in the Vatican.
There's a woman here who would like to speak, right? You came up to speak, and we've only had, it's been an all-male session here, so.
I beg your pardon.
What?
Almost all male, come on.
I'm hesitant about affirmative action at some time, but. first, I want to thank John and Derek for your remarks. I happen to disagree with both of you in almost every particular, but I think it is a brave and a loving thing to do to articulate a viewpoint that you know will be unpopular, and I admire both of you greatly. I wanted to ask, because both of you touched on, Derek, you called it trust, and John, you talked about obedience to the prophet, and this is something that I wrestled with the whole time, because I think that is finally where the rubber meets the road for all of us as church members, at least who value our membership and who take seriously our covenant to sustain our prophet. I searched in vain for anything in the definition of sustain that requires obedience to any person. As near as I can understand it, the scriptural principle of obedience requires obedience to commandments and to principles, true principles, and to the Lord. And I think that my obligation to sustain the prophet means that I listen very carefully and that I try as hard as I can to discard my own prejudices in favor of what they have said if I can. But finally believed that I had to, that the Lord would not require my obedience without, if not giving me a reason I could articulate, at least giving me the feeling that I could obey the prophet in peace. And that never happened for me. And I want to talk a little bit more about obedience and sustaining and how that question comes. I mean, John, you said it pretty strongly. You said basically you can't consider yourself an obedient member of the church and have voted differently on this, and don't want that to be true. And maybe this is all just weaseling out and justification, but I'd like you to talk a little bit more.
Sure. I don't have personal knowledge of this, but a friend of mine told me that he had talked to his bishop about his inability to sustain Prop 22, and the bishop had said that direction had come down that recommends were not to be withheld simply on that basis. So I think there's something to what you say in that this did not come down from the prophet as a commandment. In other words, anyone who does not accept this position and vote in favor of Prop 22 is out of harmony with church principles to the extent that they're unworthy to, you know, hold the blessings. On the other hand, for me, President Hinckley is the prophet of God on earth, and he did not, when he made his remarks, say, I think, or I believe, or in my personal view. I mean, to me it was clear he was speaking as a prophet and directing us regarding what the Lord's will is. Now, I believe that every member has the right and indeed the obligation to study out in their own minds what the prophets tell us and get a personal confirmation that that's the case. And in your case, if you felt like you went through that process, could not get that feeling, then, you know, I have no quibble with you if sincerely you felt like you could not vote in favor of Prop 22 despite sincere efforts to find out for yourself whether what he said to us was in fact the Lord's will. What? Yeah. True. Although it is printed in the ensign, which we all can read, even though women don't attend that meeting. But on the other hand, I do think there's a problem when church members not only don't privately support something, but come out in vocal opposition to the church's position. And that's where I think maybe the line should run, and where we do see at times leaders maybe taking action, dealing with people, advising them that they are walking on thin ice when they're not only choosing privately not to follow the counsel of the prophet, but also to come out publicly and say that they oppose what's been said. That's my response.
John, just a quick question. Yeah. David said that there was a coalition of churches. Do you think the Spirit was talking to him that way when he said that?
That the Lord directed us to work with a coalition of churches?
He said that there was a coalition of churches that were organized.
A broad coalition.
A broad coalition of churches that were organizing to oppose or to support Proposition 22.
Uh-huh.
Where do you think that came from?
I don't get your point. I'm sorry.
His point is that
there was a coalition. There wasn't a lot of effort from the members of the churches because they do not have the commitment we do to our church leaders. But there were other churches who were supporting this proposition, and their statements were printed.
But there was no coalition.
Well, they were interviewed right after the election. There was a whole bunch, Sheldon, all these people we don't like, but Sheldon and all these other guys.
This is a question for Alan. I was just wondering, did your bishop give you a criteria for getting off the probation, and if so, can you meet that criteria?
There was no criteria given. I should just stop there. But in the most recent interview I've had with the bishop, we interviewed for about an hour, and I begged him to give me what I needed to do, and he said, you got to repent. We talked about what's meant, and he said, I have to apologize for my comments, for my letters to the editor, for my comments on the internet. And I said, okay, specifically what aspects do you want me to apologize for? Where do you draw the line between I can be a member in good standing and vote no, and I can't be a member in good standing and vote no? And after an hour of begging him, he finally came up with basically three things. He said, the first thing, he said, when you're ready to repent, you'll know it, and then you'll feel good about coming in here and giving your apology. He said, number two, the church cannot be wrong. He said, if President Hinckley's standing in the front of the tabernacle and he's talking, he doesn't drop dead while he's saying it, he will never say anything wrong. And that's where he's coming from. And if he doesn't drop dead while he's saying it. And then the final thing that he told me was that basically, if I oppose Proposition 22, I oppose the church. And if I stand in opposition, in public opposition to Proposition 22, then I stand in public opposition to the church. That makes me an apostate, and it means that the disciplinary action can and will be taken. I mean, the threat was there, and even from the stake president, a veiled threat of excommunication.
Have you written anybody in Salt Lake about this?
No.
A couple of things. One, I appreciate the articulate positions that each of the people have taken. I wanted to challenge something that John Taylor said, which is that it is possible for the Holy Ghost to reveal something to the prophet and something different to an individual member. I guess I feel that this is possible. In fact, I think that one of the problems with Proposition 22 is that I would guess that the vast majority of people who voted to support it probably did not seek for a confirmation of the Spirit. And I think that it was incumbent upon everyone to seek for the confirmation. Second, I know of families who had gay children for whom this was a matter of intense prayer and seeking for guidance, and who felt inspired not to do it. And I think that it's possible for some, I think it's possible to argue that something could have been right for the church and wrong for an individual, and that both of those could come from the Holy Ghost. The second comment was, it seems to me that one of the fundamental conflicts with Proposition 22 was that it seems that we are put in a position in which a theocracy and a democracy are in conflict. And in a democracy, it seems to me, by its very definition, you cannot have anyone dictate to someone else how he or she is to cast what is one of the fundamental rights of a democracy, which is how a person votes. And I think that many people felt that the difficulty with Proposition 22 was that it was the first time in their lives when it seemed as if there was such a dictation, even though the church, the directive that came down from Elder Callister said no undue pressure should be put on any member of the church to vote in favor of Proposition 22. That was violated throughout California, in which there was intense pressure, and it seemed to me unfair pressure put on people and severe judgments made of people who did not support it. But it seems to me that there is a fundamental conflict between a theocracy and a democracy, and that you cannot have a democracy if you have anyone dictating to someone else upon any penalty that he or she cannot vote in a particular way. And in fact, if you read on page 125 and 126 of the current Priesthood and Relief Society manual, you'll hear President Joseph F. Smith stating that this church does not believe that any person should have dictated to him how to vote, that members of the church are free to vote as their conscience tells them. And this seems to be in direct conflict with what at least was the assumed understanding by the majority of members of the church about Proposition 22.
Would you like the exact quote?
Let me respond. First, as an appellate lawyer, we have U.S. authority, we have local court of appeal opinions. I posit that the words of the living prophet trump whatever is in a handbook of the church. Second, as to whether the church has ever dictated how people should vote, I hearken back to Gene England's talk, Why Orange County Mormons Should Be Democrats, which I responded to many years ago here in this forum, which he quoted the day when church leaders were directed to go down the aisles of their congregations and say, you on the left are Democrats and you on the right are Republicans, because we want to have recognition as a state and we need to have a divided set of political parties here. So the idea that the church has never directed people to take certain political positions, I don't think is true as a historical matter. And I still don't understand why on a political issue the Lord is limited and has to stay out of politics. I think when something involves a moral issue, I don't see any reason why the Lord can't get involved and tell his church members, this is a position which you should take. And I don't see how that destroys, given the size of the church, which is relatively small in our entire population in the United States, and the diversity of opinion on various issues in the country. On the last point, I think maybe you've got me to some extent, which is, can the Holy Ghost ever give someone a different answer than the church is being given as a whole? And I think I have to concede the possibility that indeed there may be a situation where in unique family circumstances there are sensitivities involving gay children or whatever, where the general rule that the prophet has given to the church may not apply to a particular individual, and indeed maybe he or she would be given a different answer. I'll concede that my point was overstated on that, and that someone could receive that kind of individual answer, but I still think that as to the church as a whole, the prophet does have the right and obligation to give us direction on these kinds of issues, and that in general the Holy Ghost will confirm that for us. That is the way to go.
Our time is up, so those who want to leave should feel free to leave now, but since there's no session following, people would like to continue the conversation are welcome to stay, but don't feel coerced socially to stay. So anyone else want to make another comment?
I wanted to make just one very quick response with the fear of taking more time than I should. I think that the size of the church should be irrelevant. If the Pope came out this week and basically stated that Catholics were to vote on some proposition that was harmful to our church, harmful to the very existence of our church, which I think is not beyond the realm of possibility, or if some other group did and basically demanded that kind of obedience of its members in a way that, and part of what I was arguing is that it seems to me the very fundamental premise of democracy. It may be that the prophet's voice trumps every other voice in the universe but God's. But in a democracy, we honor the individual responsibility of a person to do what his or her conscience dictates, and that is the very fabric on which a democracy continues to exist.
You better get rid of the labor unions then.
I quite agree. I agree with you. You make my point. If the labor unions dictate how people are to vote, if anyone does, to the point that there is coercion or judgment or penalty, then that is a violation of what we believe in and what I think the church has fought so hard for, and why, and one of the foundations on which the very the existence of the church itself depends.
I'll pass this on. Do you believe that?
I do believe that.
Because every issue involves judgment.
No, if it involves my judgment, not yours.
If you were voting yes on 22, the act said, you know, you're one of these people saying that God hates.
No, what I'm saying is that no one can take that responsibility but me. You can't tell me how to vote.
Right, I agree with that.
All right, I have to hurry here since my dad took some of my time. Derek brought up the story of Nephi and Laban, and like Nephi, when I was told how to respond or to act in this matter, my initial reaction was to say no, was told. And this comment is, I suppose, for either John or Derek to respond to. I think the most, as I searched this issue, maybe the most and only compelling issue that I found for supporting Prop 22 is the issue that John brought up of following the prophet. However, I had to weigh that gift to us, one of many gifts of knowing truth, against the other gifts that I have, including my own personal experience, my own understanding of the scriptures and the nature of God, my relationships with the homosexuals that I know, and other, and my own reason for that matter. And my question is, at what point does the word of the prophet trump all of these other God-given gifts that we have, especially in light of the doctrine of original sin, in which no one can pay for our sins other than ourselves? Isn't this understanding, the idea of somebody making correct choices for us, also in contradiction to this? And I would add that this is not the first time in my life that I've faced a dilemma in the church, and I don't think the first time for any of us. I just believe that there are times in which we need to make choices between two things that have some sense of the truth to them.
Derek, the philosopher here.
Yeah.
Hey.
I think that for me, there have been a few occasions in my life where the prophet has come out and said you need to act or think a certain way, other than established church doctrine, other than things that that I have learned through the scriptures or other means. And so this was one of the rare opportunities where I think that it was one of those situations where I, like you, had an initial reaction of, you know, I'm uncomfortable, like, because I've seen abuses in the past where people have all their political beliefs dictated by supposed church doctrine or statements of general authorities. But in this case, I saw a clear direction, in my mind, a statement that President Hinckley was making. And in that sense, that was the command to Nephi. That was it. This is something you need to do. And it might be difficult, and it might not be something you initially understand or agree with. And like Nephi at that point, I wanted to find reasons why that could be so. And for me, some of the explanations I gave were compelling. Maybe not absolutely. I mean, I definitely heard some powerful counterarguments today that gave me some things to think about. But I think I wanted to find a logical framework to put around that decision. But ultimately, I think Nephi would have done the same thing if he couldn't have thought of one reason why he shouldn't kill or should kill Laban. I think he would have done it anyway, because simply to be obedient. And I think for me, that's not taking away my agency because somebody's doing it for me. I think it's the ultimate act of faith. I think it's the hardest thing that you can do in the church, is say, I trust somebody enough to believe that they are speaking for God, that I will do that without complete understanding. That I will do that.
In the church, believe that and not do it. I mean, it seems to me it takes much more faith to believe in the prophet, to save him and to love him and to honor his office, and yet to feel compelled to go in a different direction because of your personal conscience. I think that's much harder.
Hmm.
I have an example. Let me share that.
Yeah. Actually, I'll... No, I am finished. And thank you for everybody's questions and comments. I have gotten a good deal out of all the comments about Prop 22 today. Unfortunately, I have a ward talent show that I need to get to. So, although I'm not especially talented at speaking, I am talented at doing song and dance reviews. So that's what we'll be doing tonight.
Well, actually, I want to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. This is a question handed to me to read to the panel. This question is for Alan or Janet. Both of you have demonstrated common sense reasons for voting against Prop 22. John showed how common sense shows how a loving homosexual couple could perfectly and healthily raise children. Janet showed how common sense dictates how this measure breeds bigotry. However, sometimes prophets of God defy common sense. A quick example would be Moses telling the children of Israel to look at a brazen serpent and be healed. It made no common sense immediately, but yet it was the correct choice in the long run. Inasmuch as a modern prophet has explicitly stated opposition to a matter, do you feel you are not giving him credit for knowing something that you don't? So yeah, what if it didn't make any sense to you. The reverse, yes.
Do you want to do
that? That's not an easy question. But I think Bob Reese already gave the answer. And for me, the question also has a history. It has a history, as I was explaining, of the church's position on blacks and the priesthood, and the church's position against equal rights amendment, and the church's position, which I didn't mention, against labor unions earlier. And there are a number, and there was, the church took a position against the MX missile. Well, I happen to be working for the church. The church has had many, many positions, and over time, those issues have faded. And in fact, we find ourselves sometimes, as a church, we find ourselves in a position that is in direct opposition to what the stated position of the church was 10 years before or 15 years before. And I like to think this happens because the church is a growing, living institution, and because revelation is continual and ongoing in the lives of everybody to whom God happens to give revelation. As to whether how I can say I'm smarter than somebody or my logic outweighs a revelation, all I know is what I experience.
And I made a point not to say that I thought someone else was wrong for voting how they did. I know what was correct for me, and I know had I violated that, I would feel that I had a lot to answer for, more than I want to answer for. Let me say that too. I wanted to bring out the point that I'm the only one who can really be accountable for what I do and how I vote and what I decide. And at whatever the judgment bar entails, I'm the one who has to do the answering. And I don't think it's going to be a very good answer to say, well, Gordon B. Hinckley said I should. And I think Gordon B. Hinckley himself and other prophets have said that we ourselves have to weigh these things in our mind and decide them. And I know Brigham Young certainly said we have to decide things in our own mind and come to our own conclusions on this. So I would say it's a matter of accountability. And for me, going with my conscience and going with my my sense of the origins of Prop 22 and the intent of Prop 22, and I don't think it was a referendum on gay marriage. I think it was sort of an oddly conceived addendum to family code that probably won't stand up to any kind of constitutional challenge. And I was voting on that, not on gay marriage. So.
Like Janet, I only know what I know. And I think that I've said that. So I don't want to say anything else on that particular question, but I remember... the gentleman back here asked a question. I didn't fully answer it, and it just struck me that I didn't. He said it sounds like we should maybe outlaw heterosexual marriage, based on how bad that was. But I mean, you really made my point when you said that, because the point is that heterosexual versus homosexual is not the place to draw the line. The place to draw the line is right in the other things you mentioned: the alcoholism, the abuse, the molestations, the neglect. Those kinds of things that are really, truly harmful to children and that have been demonstrated time and time again to be where the harm is.
Did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I think I would. Which won't be easy. I had a brother who killed himself at 14. And I was a Mormon and left the church. And I was 19 at the time and taking classes from Lowell Bennion, and he used to tell us that if you quit the church, you tell them it's because they won't let the blacks have the priesthood. And, you know, he was opposing what the prophet said, and he was a great man. He was loving and generous and one of the church's great men. So sure enough, I quit the church, and the missionaries came, and the first one said to me, why'd you quit the church? And I said, because the blacks can't have the priesthood. So then they sent two women, and the women said to me, why'd you quit the church? And I said, because the blacks can't have the priesthood. And they said, I'm a woman, and I can't have the priesthood, and I don't mind. And I screamed, oh, my God, that's the second reason, and I never thought about it. And I went through the ERA and picketed the temple, and, you know, I found myself, I left the church with kind of kindness in my heart, but as time went on, the ERA movement, and then I had a gay son who died of AIDS at 35, and he was supported and loved by the gay community in San Francisco, and I read Remembering Brad, how the Mormon father shut his doors and never opened them until his son was dead. And I thought, oh my God, how much worse could it be? And this just feels so unloving to me. And, you know, I listened to you talk about love this morning, and I thought, yeah, you know, that's what they need. But they're really killing it with all of this anti-women, anti-gay, men in power stuff. And I think I did want to say that, but it wasn't easy.
Thank you very much. Oh, another comment.
I just, I won't take much time since my husband already has, but I wanted to say, I'm actually sorry Derek left, because one of the main things I wanted to say was to John and to Derek who already left, thank you very much, because this discussion would not have been nearly as productive if you hadn't been brave enough to speak in an audience that might not have been as friendly as you might have liked.
Got very used to.
And I do want to say that those of us on the other side of the table are very aware of how difficult it is to speak to an audience that isn't always in agreement with your viewpoint politically. So thank you very much for being here. But one thing that I had heard touched on, and unfortunately I can't remember who it was that touched on it, but it didn't get expanded upon, and I would like to hear more about it, is the thought that that the prophet will never lead us astray, that what he says has to be right because he is the prophet. I'm not wording this as well as I would like, but I feel that the prophet leads as best he can based on his abilities and his experiences, and I believe that I was given a brain and intellect to reason out what I'm told in any forum. And I have my own experiences that I bring to the table that the prophet couldn't have. And it was mentioned earlier this has been a very male oriented meeting. Not completely. One thing I haven't heard, although Alan brought up children, he brought to the table the aspect of being a father. But what we haven't heard is that of a mother. And I want to say that as a mother, the way I perceived this, my very first thought in hearing about Proposition 22 for the very first time, I still hold to this day, and that is I have some very small children. I love them no matter what they do. They can't do anything that will make me stop loving them. And if one of them should grow up and come home and come out of the closet and have a partner, whether that child is celibate or has a partner with them when they come home, I'm still his or her mother, and I still love him or her. And because of that, I was unable to vote for this because I want all of my children to be happy and fulfilled, and I felt that this proposition would keep some of these people from doing that, and I couldn't support that. So it's an emotional argument, but it's mine.
Any comments, Nadine?
Can I just ask a follow-up question then to John that kind of goes along with what Yvette just said? One of the things that I was wondering, did you attend the session today with Mike Quinn by any chance?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. What I wonder is, does it give you any pause to think that you must always follow the prophet when you hear Mike Quinn's presentation of all of the resistance to the civil rights movement and to equality of blacks, to interracial marriage, that was consistent for, I think he said, from Brigham Young through, I guess, probably Spencer W. Kimball, and all of this anti-African-American, anti-black rhetoric that has come from the prophets of the church that has now been just swept away in one fell swoop with the revelation saying that black males can hold the priesthood. And I don't understand, I guess, how you can feel that the prophet must always be right in light of that. And now we've done a complete 180-degree turnaround. And so I wonder why you think that they can't be wrong on homosexual issues when they seem to be so obviously wrong on racial issues.
Please, what I do for a living is I'm an appellate lawyer, and I look through trial records, and I know how easy it is to pull things out of context and to paint exactly the picture you want to paint. And I do not mean to criticize the presentation earlier because I haven't looked at the scholarship. I don't fully trust it or accept it on its face the way you do. Second, I did not hear in his presentation any quote of anything that was across the pulpit to the membership of the church urging discrimination against black. He pulled quotes from internal memos, from journals, from private comments, which were not made to the body of the church. And so I do not think that what I've said about the prophet not leading us astray applies to every waking thought and every written note which they make throughout their lives. What I'm talking about is the kind of directive that comes across the pulpit in a general conference session, which is what we heard in unmistakably clear language directing us about what the churches stand on an issue. And I find that to be very different than the kind of snippets that were quoted in his presentation. Second, the things that he was quoting really had to be looked at in the context of the historical milieu in which they were made. It's easy now to look back from our perspective after the Civil Rights Movement and say, yes, you know, isn't it a shame that a leader of the church would hold a view that was consistent with the rest of society at the time? And I don't condone discriminatory feelings that church leaders may have had, which were consistent with what political environment they lived in. But I did not hear any quote where the church, as a church policy, was directing its members to discriminate against other people in the world, apart from the priesthood authorization, which took a revelation to change, and that's something it's really separate from this debate about whether the church's stand up till 1978 was an inspired one or whether it was just a culturally influenced one, and I really can't get into that this time, I don't think.
Can I just touch on that? I guess I would ask you. Let me first make a point that the question on the table is the prophet always right? And is the church always right? And the doctrine that was widely taught, I don't think that anyone questions the doctrine that was taught, was that the reason that blacks couldn't have the priesthood is because they were less valiant in the pre-existence. If that indeed is the doctrine that was being taught,
that was speculation. That was always speculation.
Everybody
believed it, but it was speculation.
That's what I'm saying. It was the belief in the church. And if you think about it,
there are lots of things believed in the church. How wide do you want to make this?
Well, but I'm just going to make my point here. My point is that it was believed in the church, and it was believed in the church. If it was believed in the church, if it was doctrine of the church, certainly Brigham Young taught the mark of Cain and other things. But if it was believed in the church, would you accept that as inspired doctrine?
I guess I don't understand your question. A general belief, not one taught across the pulpit, whether that was doctrine?
If it was the doctrine that was taught and accepted by the church, then does that still qualify as the prophet is right?
Well, it's a hypothetical that really didn't take place, so I can't really respond to it.
Let me give you a real life one.
Yeah, go ahead.
This happened to me. I saw this. I was a witness to this. Joseph Fielding Smith announced in our state conference when I was a child, a teenager, that men would never reach the moon. I heard it.
You wrote it.
Yeah, and he said it, and I heard it. And we went to the moon a few years later. And it didn't impact, doctrine, so to speak. But it was a lesson. And one thing he said that struck me hard at the time was, he said, I'm not sure why I'm saying this. And I think he wanted to feel like he was inspired in doing this, but he wasn't quite sure. And I think we do, the leaders of the church sometimes, and this is not pointed at you, John, please. Don't take it this way, or take it this way, what the heck. But I think we do them a disservice by inserting every sneeze, every comment, every statement, every preference as being, even every statement that they make when they're giving talks, as being the most current doctrine, the word of the Lord. But I think when they say they're giving the word of the Lord, they're giving the word of the Lord, and I think we need to allow them mortality.
He was an apostle, not a prophet.
Yeah, and you have to make a distinction between things that they said, I mean, even between just your average general conference topic, isn't Hinckley, and this. I mean, this was
sure.
All of the 12 and the first presidency, and that does not happen very often. I mean,
this is just an example.
Considered in a category by itself.
Yeah.
Inspired
them
into a very narrow category.
Yeah, all I'm saying is I think that we do them a disservice and we make their lives very difficult when everything that is said has to carry the imprimatur of being eternal doctrine.
I agree.
And I think when we do that, we don't allow the church to grow and to change. I was very pleased when Bruce McConkie himself, who had promoted the earlier doctrines on blacks and the priesthood, said, we were wrong. I was wrong. And we live and we learn and we grow, and the church changes and grows, and this is why we're on earth. This is a reflection of being on earth rather than everybody being in a celestial state right now. So, anyway.
Let's wrap this up and go to dinner.
Thank you.
Done.